Let me invite you to go to Hebrews chapter 12 this evening. Hebrews chapter 12. We began last week focusing on the importance in Scripture about the congregation in the spiritual safety of each of us as individuals, that God's plan for us is to go from conversion to glory in the company of God's people, and specifically in the context of the local assembly, that we would be protected from the spiritual danger of life in a sin-cursed world. And so we are looking as the base for this first two messages in Hebrews chapter 12. Look at verses 12 and 13. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. And last week I laid two foundational truths, the first of which is that following Jesus in a fallen world can wear you down. Right? The hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. It is possible that as you're walking through life, the kinds of things that the readers, the original recipients of the book of Hebrews were experiencing. There were conflicts without, facing persecution. They were suffering for their commitment to Christ. They were finding themselves excluded from their normal social circle. When I'd say that is they're originally primarily Jewish readers who now were finding themselves, when they trusted Christ, cut off from the fabric of their lives. Really, the writer of Hebrews says in the next chapter that they, just as Jesus suffered outside the camp, they too need to go outside the camp bearing the reproach of Christ. So it's not just physical persecution. Financial difficulty, chapter 10 talks about them having the seizure of their property. So they were actually having the things that they owned taken away from them because of their commitment to Christ. Chapter 13 mentions people who are in prison. So they're actually imprisoned for their faith. So it's the wide range of what I called last week, what could be triggers of this weariness. We know that long-term conflict can wear you down, whether that's physical or spiritual struggles. Some of them had sin that may be entangling them. So it's possible that you can get worn down, which is, I think, ultimately reflecting kind of diminished hope. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. When will this end? I'm not sure I can make it. I'm not going to change, or the people around me are not going to change. When will these present problems give way to promised blessings? We know that there are blessings coming. We don't always understand how God intends to get us there. Right? We can see the light affliction, which is but for a moment, works a far more exceeding eternal weight of glory. But if we're honest, it is hard sometimes to see it as light, and it's hard to see it as a moment. I mean, we will, when we get on the other side of this life, and we're into eternity, but prolonged battles can weary the soul. And we need to be honest about that, or else we won't see the need for help and the need to help. Right? That's a part of what's involved in this. So the second foundational truth is rooted in that. Following Jesus Christ in a fallen world is actually a congregational project. And this is where we were finishing last Sunday night. The need for it is by the commands here, right? Look at verse 12, strengthen the hands that are weak. So we're actually, we have commands here which are given, which point us toward other people. We are to strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. We're to be moving out. We saw it in chapter 3 where it says exhort and encourage. Chapter 10 where it says consider one another how to provoke to love and good works. So it's needed. We need to experience it. So what we need to consider moving forward tonight is the nature of it. So look at verse 12. It says, strengthen the hands that are weak. And some of you may have a translation that says, make straight, because the word that the writer uses could have either of those nuances, to build up something that has fallen, which would be the way NASB's text is taken. It's strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, or to straighten something that has been bent. And in some sense, both are appropriate, but it seems like the choice in the text is better because of the contrast with weak, right? It doesn't seem to make as much sense to say straighten the hands that are weak, right? The problem there is a loss of strength, and you're trying to give strength to provide energy to them. And when your knees begin to buckle, you know, if you're ever standing alongside of somebody, I remember we were just telling a story about when our son was in his bad accident. He was in, you know, pretty bad shape in the hospital, and someone came by to visit, and I'm standing there, and this lady who's talking to him, all of a sudden she just like falls into me because she was looking at his injuries, and then she just started to pass out. Right. All of a sudden, you know, her knees went weak, right? And so, you know, what was my natural response? No, right? No, you try to support the person whose knees have gone feeble or wobbly. Man, today's not a good day for me trying to say words, right? So you try to strengthen. How do I support this person who's about to collapse? And that's what I think the writer is calling us to do, is to recognize that the weak and feeble need strength. I mentioned last week that many see this as an allusion to Isaiah chapter 35. And if so, the verse right after the one that's being referenced says this: say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, and he will save you. In other words, what in Isaiah 35 is the weak hands and feeble knees are strengthened by reminders of God's promises and encouragements to trust him. So he's using a physical language, but it's really an image of what we're to do spiritually for somebody. Right? Their hands are getting weak. Their knees are getting feeble, and what Isaiah 35 does is point that person to the promises of God as the source of strength and encourage them to keep trusting in God. And that fits the context here in Hebrews, because these people were becoming weary in the process of following Christ, and the writer wants the congregation to speak God's truth to people so that their hands don't fall down, so their knees don't buckle. The way you support them is by pointing them to the promises of God and encouraging them to remain trusting in him, because he will keep his promises. Right? There's that kind of encouragement that happens. Look then in verse 13, because here it's talking about straightening the paths for walking. Make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. And again, it's appropriate and common to see verse 13 as being an allusion to the kind of language found in Proverbs chapter 4, which talks about having a pathway smooth, right? Make your pathways smooth or straightened out. And so if you listen to the context of that, it says, Proverbs 4, let your eyes look directly ahead and let your gaze be fixed in front of you. Watch the path of your feet, or could be translated, make level paths for your feet, and all your ways will be established. Do not turn to the right or to the left. Turn your foot from evil. So I think what the writer is saying here is that the community, the people in the assembly of God, accept responsibility to keep everyone focused on the right path, doing everything that can be done to keep people from getting distracted off the path of following Christ. Because that's the challenge in perseverance, right? All the way back in chapters 2 and 3, he starts talking about holding fast to our confession, right? We've confessed Christ, but now the opposition that's coming is causing some of them to potentially back away from it. They're trying to get relief from the struggle and the battle. And so what the congregation of God's people is to actually try and help people keep their eyes focused forward and moving in a straight line, because if you go off the road, the damage will not be stopped. It'll actually be worsened. Right? Then look at what the language is. So the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Here's the deceptive temptation. Right. If I'm walking down this path and it's hurting to walk down this path, I need to look for a different path. But actually, if you go down the different path, the limb actually will be damaged worse. And if you continue down this path, there will be healing. That's what he's saying, right? Straighten the paths, so that the limb which is out of joint may not be put out of joint. You won't actually, the lame won't be put out of joint. If you think, well, I just got to take off on this side path because there's too much trouble over here. I'm hurting. I'm weakened. Over here will give me rest. And you actually step off into disaster. Whereas if you trust the promises of God, actually, this pathway will be the pathway that brings the healing. So we're supposed to help each other stay on that pathway. How many times over the years of your life have you seen somebody think a shortcut will be the best option for them? And the shortcut ends up disastrous. Right? They think they can cut the corner on some issue, or they can skip out on some problem, and really they're so convinced that they need relief. They're so convinced that they need rest. They're so convinced that they need to find some kind of way of escape from this on their own. And they step, in the language we use, from the proverbial frying pan into the fire. Right? But when they turn away from the source of God's grace, they turn toward more trouble. And the thing that, if you take the first two things I talked about, right, that following Christ can wear us out, and faithfully following Christ is a congregational project, it's precisely because when a person is at that moment of weariness, they are not thinking correctly. Right? They think that the answer is to jump. And it's the result of the fact that they're not thinking properly biblically. They're being, to use the language of chapter 3, they're being affected by the deceitfulness of sin. Right? They're thinking, boy, if I could just get out of this pressure, then I'll be able to get my feet back under me. Right? That's the lie. But if I could just get off of this rough path, I'll actually do better. And they step into disaster. Right? The weakened limb is put out of joint. And that's, that's the sad thing that you see so often, is people are tempted to not trust God when they're in a prolonged battle. There's probably a lot of reasons for that, but at least a part of it is we live in a culture that has become so conditioned to immediate relief. Right? We want rapid, quick solutions. And sometimes we just cannot see the foolishness of it. Right? I mean, so, you know, a couple that's had marriage problems for 20 years wants it all to be solved in 2 weeks. Right? They've got 20 years of sinful habits in how they communicate to each other, in the way they respond to it. Right? They've got deeply ingrained patterns, and what they want is relief. And they want it now. And you know what our world says? Bail. Right? God can't want you unhappy like this. God, you know, God wouldn't want you to be miserable. God wouldn't want all the lies of the devil that cause a person to think, well, if I just get off the path for a little bit, everything will be okay. And God knows that that's the challenge for us. That's sometimes like a person, swimming in the ocean, desperately dying for something to drink, who starts drinking the ocean water, and it actually has the counter effect, right? It doesn't actually hydrate you. It ends up dehydrating you and killing you. Or the person who's out in the desert and they keep seeing the mirage and they chase after the mirage, and all it does is lead them farther and farther into the danger. That's what it's like to live in a fallen world and isolate yourself from the fellowship of God's people, the kind of mutual exhortation and encouragement that God has built into the path of sanctification. So let me just suggest some implications of these things. That means, I think, if we're honest, right? If we're really honest with ourselves before the Lord, we should humbly acknowledge the battle in ourselves and carefully watch for it in those around us. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Right? If you sit here tonight and go, yeah, I'm sure there's some people whose hands get weak and knees get feeble. Buttercups, they should just suck it up. And you think that you're not susceptible to the same afflictions that are happening, then the scriptures would give you a really sort of profound warning. Let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. Because how many times have you had somebody you never would have suspected have a major tragic failure in their life? I mean, that's like, it's actually the whole point of the devil's sinister attacks, is to get us in a position where we think we're invulnerable to it, because then we're susceptible to it. Well, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's not, you know, I don't really have a problem with this. I'm not really. So we must maintain, by God's grace, the kind of humility that recognizes that sin is always a threat to us. If you don't think it is, you are in the most vulnerable position going. What that usually means is the other person's sin is not a threat to you. Right? Like, I cannot think of one time in my life when I grew up, when it was more common for people to smoke and all that, where I was like really tempted to smoke. So like, it would be easy to look at, you know, look at people and go, what's wrong with you? I mean, why would you want to do that? Right? I mean, It's something that had no appeal to me. So it's easy for me to look at the things that have no appeal to me and think, I'm doing okay. The whole point of the sinister nature of sin is that the attack is going to be actually in places where you're not really looking. And you might be sympathetic to, and therefore gradually tolerate, until you actually have opened up a gap in which the devil can strike. We need to have the kind of humility that acknowledges that, and we must carefully watch for it in those around us, right? Spot the signs in ourselves and in others. When are people vulnerable? If we look at the book of Hebrews, when they're discouraged, right? Maybe controlled by fear, overwhelmed by failure, a growing sense of hopelessness. When you feel that in your heart, or you start to hear that in the language of someone else, it should cause you to recognize your danger and or theirs. When you start to see people whose lives are beginning to be distracted from the most important things, if I could put it in the language of the text, their pathways are not straight any longer. They're looking to the right. They're looking to the left. Right? They're starting to keep their field of vision, or have their field of vision spread out past what God would want them to. That's a different one. Right? They're potentially distracted. Right? So they need to keep their eye. So we just plan in these illustrations at all times. It's pastoral pedagogy, right? So you need to have paths that are straight morally, spiritually, practically, right? And here's what I'd say is we're talking about congregationally, right? You can see, and you could probably, if you've been following Christ for a long time, one of two things could be true for you. You can probably remember times when things that were minor started to take you away from things that were major in your life. Right? You just started to shift your eyes, and all of a sudden things that in the big picture are not as important as they really are start to take hold of your life. And you start to make trade-offs. Right? I mean, the most obvious for us is time in the Word and prayer gets traded away to keep up with what's going on in the world. Right? Get up and check all the news, or stay up late and surf the web and be too tired to read your Bible and pray in the morning. In the relative scale of things, like which one of those is more important to your life? I mean, I don't think any of us would even debate that, right? But all of a sudden, we can just start to go sideways, right? And so in our own heart or in the people around, we don't ever hear them talking about what they're learning in the Word. Right? We never hear anything like that, but we can hear about everything else. So something's getting out of balance. Or folks who used to be regular and disciplined in their gathering with the assembly to worship may have been actively serving, and all of a sudden starting to become hit and miss, starting to be passive instead of active for Christ. Right? Are we aware of it when it happens in our heart? Do we pay attention when it's happening in other people's lives? Because that's chapter 10, which said, consider one another, how you can provoke to love and good works. When the pathway starts to get crooked, are we going, well, I'm a little concerned, that person's seeming to go off the pathway. Or have we bought the spirit of the age that says, well, you know, I'm not my brother's keeper. Right? Who am I to say anything to them? Well, actually, you're a part of the household of God, and this is your brother or sister. So we need to be careful about that, right? I know what can happen. I want to say this carefully and hopefully graciously, right? Sometimes perpetual whiners can wear us out, right? There are some people who are not happy unless they're unhappy. And that can cause us at times to just sort of back away. But we can't let the exceptions invalidate the rule that we need to care for people. We need to be cared for, right? We need to have that and not let, people who are just nosy or curious or gossips, right? They just always want to find out what's going on in every other's business. So you know what we do? We go, well, I'm just going to mind my own business. Right, so we can let people who are responding incorrectly keep us from doing what God wants us to do. Because you know what, we're not supposed to be nosy busybodies, but we are supposed to consider one another how we can provoke to love and good works. We're supposed to be paying attention so we can exhort and encourage one another daily while it's called today. And we're not supposed to be whiny and complainy and grumbly, but we are supposed to share our burdens so people can help us, right? And here's what I think the devil can do. He can use people who violate the scriptures to sometimes cause us to not obey the scriptures. We become passive about things we're supposed to be active. I actually am supposed to be paying attention to the spiritual well-being of other people. And I take my pastor hat off. As a Christian, a believer, I'm supposed to be paying attention. Right? As a believer, I'm supposed to be seeking the help and encouragement and prayer of other people. An isolated life is not God's plan. It's not. And it almost never works out right. Because people just keep receding away from Christ when they pull away from Christ's body. Go over to chapter 10 just real quick, and we'll come back to this in the series. But I want you to see this because I know this is like, here's what I say, buckle up, because we're just not used to hearing the way the scriptures would talk, right? So I've just quoted a few times verse 24, right? Just so you can pick up the sentence, right? Look at verse 23. It starts with a capital letter, right? So that's the beginning of the sentence. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. And notice this is the way in which we would be doing that, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. And then some of our translations, unfortunately, insert a header. But look at the first word of verse 26. For, so that means it's an explanation of what just preceded it. Right? Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves, but rather do these things. For if we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of fire which will consume the adversaries. So I don't think that's just tied to the not forsaking assembling in order to consider. I think it's tied to holding the confession of faith. But here's the argument that the writer of Hebrews is making. I'd say it this way, right? Generally, the first step away from Christ is a step away from the congregation of Christ. Where does God meet with us? Where is God exalted in our midst? Where are the conduits of God's grace given to us? When we turn our back on the assembly, we are actually turning our back on Jesus. It's His bride. It's His body. And we've got to constantly go, I think, to war with that in our heart, because we have decades of American Christianity that thinks it's just me and Jesus. Right? And I can be good. I can love Jesus and not love His church. I can love Jesus and not care about His people. Everything's good with me. And that's just, you absolutely cannot defend that from the scriptures. It cannot be done, because the very nature of regeneration is that you love God and you love those who are born of God. And that you can't say you love the God you can't see while having a heart that's hardened against the ones that you can. And that's what John says in 1 John. That's what the writer of Hebrews is saying. Here's what I suggest to you, that one of the clearest signs of the welfare of your soul is whether you're moving toward God's people or away from God's people. Because it's a window into, I think, your humility. Because you're not putting yourself ahead of everybody else and the work of Christ. And also your hunger for growth. It's just really crucial. All right. So here again, I said this last Sunday night, you're here. Right. Praise God. Part of it would be, I'm saying this to encourage our commitment, but also to recognize that a part of what we have to cultivate is a heart for the fact that the first sign of departure from Christ might be the person that we know, that we care about, that is stepping away from the fellowship and encouragement of the congregation of God's people. And too often, right, too often, if there's a culture that treats participation in the assembly as just showing up for a service, that actually creates this. Because people think they're okay spiritually. It's like tag, right? I'm good. Covered it for this week. Sunday morning comes around. I touched home base, so I'm good again. And then pretty soon it starts to be, well, I haven't touched home base in a while. I need to get back to church. Right? And then it just keeps drifting away. Because they're not living comfortably within the congregations of God's people. They're just seeing it as an ancillary kind of thing. And here's the thing that I'm most burdened about. So we could watch that happen with somebody and never come along and go, I wonder if it's because their hands are getting weak, or if their feet or their knees are getting feeble, or if their path is getting crooked, right? Is there something I need to do to come along to strengthen those hands, to help make straight the pathway? Is there something I need to do to minister to them? And honestly, sometimes it's because there's actually physical weakness, and so we need to move with the love of Christ to meet needs. But it requires us to be attentive, right? To be aware of those things. Go back to chapter 12. So the primary thing is we must humbly acknowledge and the battle in ourselves and carefully watch for it in those around us. And a part of the antidote to that is, you know, I'm going to skip that one. Go to the beginning of the chapter. All right. I told you this is going to an ever expanding series. So. I'm going to do that. I'm going to bypass some stuff. We'll come back to the Lord willing. Here's a part of what we would do, though, right? We must point people to Jesus. Look at verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, and those witnesses are not people sitting in the grandstands of heaven watching us, by the way. Those are testimonies, right? Chapter 11 has been all of these testimonies of faith that God, you know, God had approved of their faith. And so this cloud in chapter 11 of testimonies or witnesses, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. There's the weariness and the challenge. And what's the answer? Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of God. Listen, if a body needs rest due to weakness, then get some rest. Right? I'm not in any way suggesting that the antidote to physical weariness is some spiritual experience. Right? What I am saying though is the antidote to spiritual weariness is Jesus. And it's seeing in him what he has accomplished. He's the author and perfecter of faith, and he has sat down at the right hand. Right? He has won the battle. He's run the race. He's finished it. And how did he do it? He did it by enduring and despising the shame. The writer of Hebrews is saying, listen, Jesus has already gone down this pathway ahead of you. He understands what it means to have to endure and to face shame. And he did it because he knew the joy that was before him. He believed the promises, just like the examples in chapter 11. Right? They did all that they did by faith. They sought a city whose builder and maker was God. If they had been mindful of the place from which they came, they no doubt could have returned. But they weren't looking backward. They were looking forward. And that's the same thing with Jesus. Jesus knew there was joy in front of him. So he endured. He persevered in obedience to his Father. And then finish the race. And look at verse 3. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Right? The victory of Jesus is to give us strength and encouragement, because he has overcome the things that we're currently facing. Right? And that's why chapter 2 and chapter 4 talk about him being a sympathetic high priest. He's been tested in everything that we have, yet without sin. He's able to come to the aid of those who are tempted, because the Son of God has actually walked this pathway. He had contradiction of sinners against himself. He understood the frailty of humanity. Right? He understands that and can minister to us, and has promised to do so. There's no greater demonstration of both the frailty and victory of Jesus than the cross. God cannot die. So the Son of God took to himself a human nature so that through death he could obtain the victory over death. Right? Jesus made himself subject to the infirmity of humanity. He tasted death, chapter 2 says, so that he could bring many sons to glory. When we think about what Jesus did for us and then the victory he obtained for us, it will cause us, when we fix our eyes on him, when we consider him, it will cause us to not grow weary and not lose heart. Right? I really would love to say a ton, but just go back to what I said about someone wanting to sort of get off the pathway so that they can find some rest. Right? I already said, if your body's weary, get rest. I'm talking about someone who's saying, I'm going to stop following Jesus because I need to get refreshed. Right? Think about it. It's the exact opposite of what God says. He says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Consider him, and you won't be weary and you won't lose heart. If you say, I need to just sort of pull off to the spiritual rest area and focus on myself for a while, because if I don't focus on myself, I'm not going to be able to serve Christ, because that's the lingo of our day. I've got to do some self-care here. Right? And what we do is we turn our attention to ourselves, which means we're not fixing our eyes on Jesus. We're not considering him. Right? It might seem like a wise suggestion, but I would suggest to you that it's actually the wrong antidote. Right? Jesus is the one who gives us strength. He's the one who gives us hope. He won the victory and is the perfecter of faith, so he can keep you. He can strengthen you. He can cause you to have hope when you become weary and start to lose heart. Don't look away from Jesus. And that's what we should always be telling one another. That the answer is not over there. The answer's there with Jesus. Right? That's what the writer of Hebrews is doing. And that's what tonight we're doing. We're coming to the table and we're fixing our eyes on Jesus, who endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand. He won the victory for us, so it can be ours in him.